Lecture 4, The Story of the Buddha.
When someone encounters Buddhism for the first time, the first and most natural question, really, it's a question I suspect that you've been asking for yourselves, is simply this: who was the Buddha, and who was the man who set this incredibly rich and complex religious tradition in motion? This is the lecture now when we finally have a chance to address that question directly and to speak about the life of the Buddha. If you're at all curious about the impact this man has had on the lives of the people of India, where he was born and in all the other countries, including modern America, where Buddhism has become such an important part of the religious landscape, it's natural to ask another question, too. How did the life story of this person we call the Buddha, become so deeply woven into the lives of the people who call themselves Buddhists? In this lecture, I'd like really to do two things: to tell you the story of the Buddha, and also to reflect about the way that story has been mirrored in the lives of the Buddhist people throughout Asia, who have oriented their life in one way or another around this classical image of what the Buddha was, how he acted, and how he set the tradition in motion. Historically, we've just got a handful of facts we can hold on to tell ourselves about the life story of the Buddha. We know, or we think we know, that he was born in the family of King Suddhodana and Queen Maya about the year 566 BCE, in a region of the Indian subcontinent that now lies in southern Nepal. He was a member of the Shakya tribe. His clan name was Gautama, and his given name was Siddhartha, which means something like goal achieved or maybe mission accomplished. It's been common in the Buddhist world to refer to him either as Siddhartha Gautama, or even more commonly as Shakya Muni, the sage of the Shakya tribe. He's often called by this name, especially in East Asia, when he's distinguished from other Buddhas who represent other traditions that we'll discuss when we move on to the discussion of the Mahayana. This handful of facts is important to us. They tell us that the Buddha was not a figment of somebody's imagination. He was a real human being who walked the dusty roads of northern India 2,500 years ago, at a time when India and many other important regions around the world were going through a process of fairly intense religious ferment. But these facts don't tell us very much about what the Buddha did or about what he has meant to his followers in the Buddhist tradition. To learn about the Buddha this way, we have to turn to stories Buddhists tell about the Buddha and learn to look at the Buddha through Buddhist eyes. To tell the story of the Buddha the way Buddhists tell it, we have to begin not with his birth, but with his previous births. As I said in the last lecture, the Buddhist tradition arose at a time when the doctrine of reincarnation was a basic assumption of Indian religious life. People assumed that human beings did not live just one life and then go on to some kind of reckoning in the afterlife. They cycled around again and again in a process of death and rebirth, and not a very pleasant process. In fact, this process, as you know, is called samsara, not to be confused. I didn't mention this in the last lecture, not to be confused with the perfume of the same name, which expresses, I think, a rather different conception of human life. The word samsara in classical India meant simply to wander from one life to the next, potentially without end. How you feel about this depends a lot on how you feel about the process of an endless sequence of lives in this world, or possibly in worlds that may not be quite as pleasant as the one that we presently inhabit. In India, serious religious people began to think that samsara was not an appealing prospect. To my classes in Boston, I say that the best way to recreate this feeling for themselves in a local way is to imagine that they are born again and again as Red Sox fans, doomed life after life to the frustration of another doomed pennant race. There were no Red Sox fans in ancient India, but the inhabitants of ancient India knew about frustration, and they thought that the great sages like the Buddha could find a way out. In fact, they assumed that someone as important as the Buddha must have prepared for this possibility through an enormous number of previous lives, by studying under previous Buddhas, and by practicing all the virtues that would come to such glorious fruition in his life as the Buddha Shakyamuni. The stories of the Buddha's previous lives are told in a body of texts known as the Jataka, or birth tales. In their English translation, these tales occupy 6 hefty volumes. When I'm in my classes at Boston University, I often threaten to bring them in and stack them right up on the lectern so that everyone can see them. They are 6 enormous tomes and express in quite an elaborate way Buddhist vision of all that had to happen in previous lives before this young man could undertake the career to become a Buddha. Many of these tales are quite simple and almost childlike, and they sound best, at least they sound best to me, when they can be told with the lilting cadences of a child. I probably can't recreate the right kind of childlike voice myself, but you should imagine, as I tell a Jataka tale, what it would be like if it were told by your favorite 7-year-old grandson, grandchild, or niece, or nephew. Once upon a time, the story goes like this. There were 3 animals, a monkey, an elephant, and a partridge, and they began to discuss which one of them was the oldest of the bunch. The oldest was the one who would deserve special respect. The elephant pointed to a giant fig tree just out there, somewhere in the distance. Fig trees, of course, in India are the biggest of the trees and the most impressive. They really are almost like cathedrals in some parts of India. He pointed to this gigantic fig tree and said that when he was young, he could walk over the top of it and its leaves would barely touch his belly. The monkey said that when he was young, he could stretch out his neck and eat sprouts from the top of the tree. The partridge said that when he was young, he ate a seed and it passed through his body and grew up to become the tree. The elephant and the monkey then bowed down and paid him homage. It's nice to be reminded, actually, even in the cadences of a 7-year-old, that this is a tradition where it's not a bad thing to be old. The Jataka tale ends, like all the others, with a common formula. The Buddha says, and I, the Buddha, was that partridge. What he's saying, really, is that he was born in that life in the form of a partridge to teach a simple moral lesson that would then become one of these formative moral tales around which the Buddhist tradition would revolve. Technically, the being who appeared as the partridge was not actually the Buddha, in a technical sense. He didn't become the Buddha until the life when he was born as Siddhartha Gautama. Buddhists refer to the partridge instead as a bodhisattva, a word that will be important for us in the course of these lectures. It means something like a Buddha to be, or possibly a future Buddha, someone who is moving on the way to the Buddhahood that will eventually define the character of Siddhartha Gautama. You can see that Buddhists, in one way or another, whether they're little children or the most sophisticated monks or nuns, have to grapple with what it means for themselves to be bodhisattvas. The ideal of the bodhisattva is, in a sense, not something rarefied and removed from ordinary experience. It's something that applies to the ordinary experience that we would have ourselves as Buddhist laypeople and as Buddhist children The stories teach moral lessons for everybody, not just for the people who expect to be Buddhas in this life. When his career as a bodhisattva came almost to its end, the bodhisattva was born as the son of Suddhodana and Maya. As you can imagine, in a religious tradition like this, the story of his birth is full of miraculous signs. According to Buddhist tradition, the future Buddha sprang right out of his mother's side, took 7 steps to the north, and announced in a commanding voice, "I am the best of the world. This is my last birth. I will never be born again." Now, these were not usual events, even in classical India, and they seem to have gotten his father's attention. Suddhodana, the prince, called the palace sages together and asked them to explain the meaning of what had just happened. They saw that there were wheels inscribed on the palms of Siddhartha's hands and on the soles of his feet, and they told his father that the child was destined to become what's called in Buddhist tradition a chakravartin, a wheel turner, someone who turns a wheel. The wheels could mean either that he would turn the wheel of conquest around India and become a great king, or he could turn the wheel of religious teaching and become a great sage. Either way, the wheel was the symbol of his status as what's called a Mahapurusha, a great person, someone who was truly a hero in one of these 2 senses. The 8-spoked wheel of the Buddha's teaching is still used as a symbol of Buddhism in temples, Buddhist sculpture, and in that great 20th century innovation, an international Buddhist flag. It's often used as the symbol of the Buddhist tradition as a whole. Siddhartha's father tried to protect him from the suffering of the world in the hope that he would not choose what to him was the rather disreputable and troubling option of becoming a religious ascetic, in the style of renunciation that we have already talked about in the last lecture. For a while, the young man's father was successful. Siddhartha was married, he had a child, and seemed for a while to be quite content with his protected life in the palace. But one day he was out riding in a park, and he saw 4 sights, crucial sights in the history of the Buddhist tradition and in their sense of the evolving life of this young man, someone who was sick, someone who was old, a corpse, and a wandering ascetic in the style of sannyasa that we spoke about last time. According to the story, this young guy, Siddhartha, in his early 30s, was shocked by what he saw. He really had been protected, at least according to the tradition, from anything like this before. He was shocked by the vision of suffering that it conveyed to him, and he decided to leave the palace to become an ascetic himself. This really was the defining moment in the early career of this young man. His process of leaving the palace, of shaving his head and giving away his possessions and taking up the robe and begging bowl of a wandering monk, is a crucial event for traditional Buddhists. It's enacted every time a young man in a Theravada Buddhist country in Southeast Asia goes through the ritual process of entering the monastery and becoming a monk. As a monk, Siddhartha did not find much success, at least immediately. He joined a group of other ascetics and tried to confront the problems of old age and death by starving himself until he was nothing but skin and bones. There are some powerful Buddhist images of this phase in Siddhartha's life that show him with his eyes sunk deep in their sockets and the veins standing out on his rib cage. It wasn't clearly a particularly pleasant time for him, and it didn't bring him the results that he wanted. So he accepted a bowl of rice pudding from a young woman who met him exhausted on the side of a river. And he withdrew from this harsh style of asceticism into a practice, a form of practice that Buddhists have traditionally referred to as the middle path, another important concept in Buddhist life. The concept of the middle path colors all sorts of aspects the way Buddhists live. The point is to avoid two extremes, and the extremes can vary in certain situations. One is an extreme of self-denial, to deny yourself too much, not to care appropriately for the needs of the body and the personality. The other extreme is an extreme of self-indulgence, and a form of indulgence that affects not just the way people live, but also, in a sense, the way people think, especially the way they think about themselves. Buddhist philosophers constantly ask what it means to talk about ourselves as being a self. They often disagree about how best to define it, but they agree that the self should not be indulged, it should not be affirmed too much, and it also should not be denied. So the proper view of the personality, according to the Buddhist tradition, is in itself a middle path, a way of cultivating the self with a certain sense of responsibility, but also avoiding any sense of self-indulgence. We'll talk about the fine details of this issue when we discuss Buddhist philosophy in a later lecture. Once Siddhartha found the middle path, things began to move more quickly for him. He sat down under a tree and he fixed himself in meditation. He was tempted by Mara, who is the personification of death in the Buddhist tradition, who first sent his daughters to seduce Siddhartha and then sent his armies, the armies of his son, to distract him. I've begun to think of these armies not so much in the way it often has been presented traditionally in Buddhist literature as the armies of Mara that are out there, you know, fighting the Buddha to try to scare him away from the serious conviction, the serious commitment of his meditation, but in some way as the last vestige of his life as a prince. Fascinated by this, actually. It's almost as if this young guy, what was he say, 35, 36, something like that, we can only really guess at the exact age, had tried to turn his back on the princely life that he once had lived and was now attempting to seek this solution to the problem of transmigration. And out of his past came the old gang. All of these guys that he used to fight with, and say, they said to him, Siddhartha, come on out and fight with us, just like we used to do back there on the playground. Be a prince like you once were. The story, of course, in Buddhist literature is that he resisted the temptation that these armies presented, and he reached down in his meditation and touched the earth. The earth shook to bear witness to the strength of his conviction. Now, once this happened, of course, once Mara had been defeated, Siddhartha was on his way to enlightenment. In the dark of the night, he passed through stages of meditation and finally understood what caused the suffering of the world and how he could bring it to a definitive end. This was the moment when we can properly call Siddhartha the Buddha. Often the word Buddha is translated as the enlightened one. This is a common translation, and I suppose it's not a bad thing to use it. It certainly is a translation that's understandable to many people, but technically it's a little bit misleading. Buddhists say that a Buddha is someone who has awakened from the dream of ignorance and also whose wisdom has blossomed like a flower. The root that lies behind the word Buddha can mean to wake up from a dream, and it also can be used to refer to a rose, to speak of its opening, of its blossoming. These days, we generally translate the word Buddha as the awakened one. It also, I suppose, would be fine to say that he's the one who has blossomed. But that doesn't sound quite right in English, so I think I'll stick with the word awakened. When Siddhartha became a Buddha, he also achieved the state, or the goal that Buddhists call nirvana. There's a lot of confusion about nirvana in our world, of course, and Buddhists don't make matters any easier when they insist that only a Buddha can really know what nirvana actually is. Certainly not us. How could I know such a rarefied and elusive state? For the rest of us, it may be enough to know simply what the word itself means. I suspect, actually, that this will take us closer to the experience of nirvana, to understanding it as a concept and experience, than many of us would suspect. Nirvana means to extinguish or to blow out. So a Buddha is someone who not only has understood the causes of suffering, but has blown them out. He no longer suffers from the ignorance and desire that feed the fire of death and rebirth. Now, as you think about this ideal, as you think about the story of the Buddha's life, you might ask yourselves why Buddhists find this to be attractive, particularly the concept of nirvana. The answer goes back to the idea of samsara that we've already discussed. Buddhists took the problem of death and rebirth very seriously. In fact, the concept of nirvana is a gauge of how serious the issue of samsara was that we spoke about last time. It was only a great sage who could escape the cycle of death and rebirth. In a more positive way, you can also sense how nirvana involves a sense of freedom and calm that's missing from ordinary life in this world. The Buddha no longer had anything to worry about once he had achieved this breakthrough, this experience of his awakening. For him, all the storms of samsara were over. He was free from that, and he could live his life in the awareness that he would never come back into the cycle of frustration, in the cycle of samsara again. Tradition says that the Buddha was tempted to stay under the tree of his awakening and enjoy the experience of nirvana for himself. But instead he got up and he walked to a town called Sarnath in the outskirts of the city of Banaras, the great Hindu pilgrimage site on the bank of the Ganges River. And he taught about his awakening to a group of ascetics. This event is called his first turning of the wheel of the law, and it represents, in many ways, the beginning of Buddhist tradition, the beginning of the time when the Buddha's teaching came to be expressed and handed on by a group of followers. From this point on, the Buddha had a long and fruitful monastic career, walking the roads of northern India, teaching to kings, peasants, merchants, converting monks and nuns, and presiding eventually over a thriving and rather complex monastic order. There are many wonderful stories about this phase in the Buddha's life. Each of us, I suppose, has a favorite. For its combination of psychological vividness with a dose of the miraculous, I particularly like the story of a guy named Angulimala, a monk whose name means a garland of fingers. When the story starts, Angulimala is a pious student, eager to please a demanding teacher. This may actually be the real reason why I like it. It's kind of a nice story about teachers and students. Angulimala is a wonderful and dutiful student, and he does everything that he can to please his teachers, and of course, he arouses the jealousy of his classmates. They go to the teacher and begin to tell some stories about him that aren't terribly attractive. And so the teacher decides to get some revenge on Angulimala by calling him in and saying, listen, there's one more payment I expect from you before I will give you my final teaching. Angulimala says, oh, yes, great master, what is it? What can I do for you? And he says, I want you to bring me the fingers of 100 people you have killed for yourself, and then I will give you my final teaching. And Angulimala, ever the dutiful student, sort of packs up his books and splits for the countryside and begins to kill people and collect their fingers. At first, he hides them somewhere in the forest, but eventually he begins to lose them, and so he collects them together, according at least to one version of the story. He begins to collect them together in a garland around his neck, hence this rather grisly name, Angulimala, the Garland of Fingers. Now, the king gets wind of this, of course. The villagers tell him about it, and he sends a hit squad out to do something about Angulimala and put him out of business. And the Angulimala's mother hears about it, of course, and still is very much protective of her son and wants to go out and warn him that the king's enforcers are coming to arrest him. And the Buddha also hears about it, realizes that by this time Angulimala is so far gone that he would kill his own mother to get her fingers, and that would be a terrible thing. So the Buddha goes into the forest to dissuade Angulimala, to somehow lead him away from this life that he has fallen into. And at this point, the story, in my opinion, really becomes quite charming. The Buddha walks slowly on a path through the forest. Angulimala is out there and sees him coming and starts running to catch him and steal his fingers. But as he chases the Buddha through the forest, somehow the Buddha manages to glide just a step ahead of Angulimala. And Angulimala says to him, stop, stop, in the wonderful elaborations that you hear sometimes in Sri Lanka. There's a wonderful actual use of epithets about the Buddha. Angulimala starts out saying, stop, you bald-headed rascal. I want to get your fingers. And the Buddha turns around and says to him, I have stopped, Angulimala. Why don't you stop? And Angulimala says, you haven't stopped. Every time I try to catch you, you slip away into the underbrush. The Buddha says, I have stopped all of the causes of death and rebirth. Why don't you stop? And at this point, Angulimala reverts back to the old student that he once was, and he falls down at the feet of the Buddha in tears and asks to be taught about the meaning of death and rebirth, and how he himself can begin to unravel that cycle of suffering that he has inadvertently cast himself into. And he goes on then to become one of the remarkable early followers of the Buddha, and a person who's invoked in remarkable ways throughout the Buddhist tradition in Southeast Asia. Now, stories like this are typical in a sense of the career of the Buddha. I won't say that they're all as unusual as the story of Angulimala. Many of the conversion experiences follow a much more typical religious form, something that would be familiar to us in other religious traditions as well. But they point to a certain way in which the Buddha was able to tune in to the particular religious needs of his followers and crystallize some kind of religious transformation that was deeply personal for them and that oriented them in a powerful way on the path to nirvana that he himself had followed. At about the age of 80, the Buddha's teaching career finally came to an end. It was long, it was productive, but eventually it came to an end. He gave his last teaching to the monks, lay down between two trees, and passed gently from the cycle of death and rebirth. Buddhists call this event his parinirvana, his complete nirvana, the fulfillment of everything that he had set out to accomplish when he saw the four sights in the park outside his palace. Now, I said earlier that the Buddha's life didn't begin with his birth. You also could say that it doesn't end with his death. Before he died, he told his disciples to cremate his body and to distribute his relics. So after he died, the disciples of the Buddha distributed relics and established a cult that venerated his physical form. They also passed on his teaching in ways that were important to later generations of Buddhists. We'll talk about all of that in future lectures. For the moment, I think it's enough for us to say that we clearly know from this story that the Buddha was a human being. Not a god, not a manifestation of God, but simply a human being like ourselves who confronted the fundamental problems of life and attempted to find a solution. As he did this, he located himself in an ancient tradition of Indian asceticism, but also brought that tradition into a distinctive form that was then available to other cultures in Asia. In a malleable and creative way. And it's that transformation of the Buddha's example and the image of the Buddha's life that we'll discuss further now in the lectures that lie ahead of us.